could barely see his own hand. The only light came from the Andrax's dim and slitted eyes. "Point your face this way, will you? I can't see a damn thing." The Star Eater obliged, opening its eyes wider. Blaze undid the latch on the hinge panel on the front of the case and swung the panel open. He reached for the Abaquen. As soon as his fingers touched the smooth, cool ivory, he stopped. The room prior to this had absolutely, definitely been a laboratory for sorcerers. He knew what sorcerers were like. Suspicious creatures who imagined everyone else was as conniving and covetous as they were. He took hold of the carving, then moved into the shadows. Only then did he lift it. With a metal clang, something shot up beneath him. Spears, emerging from the step he was standing on. If he'd been wearing his normal, meat-based body, he'd have been impaled, and one of the spears would currently be waving his dangly bits as a flag. He chuckled softly. Heavy clunks sounded from all sides. He craned his neck in mild confusion. What next? Machines that shot arrows at him? Then rocked back on his feet. The entire room was flooding with water. 16. The water swirled across the floor in a foaming torrent. If he'd been your average non-shadow-walking type, and had somehow avoided the spears and had jumped off the step, he would currently be getting swept into the back of the room, either to be smashed into the back wall and drowned, or to be carried into some insidious Nethermancer's trap to be held until authorities arrived, or possibly just to be held down for more effective drowning. Either way, he very much doubted that his current situation had gone without notice. He motioned to the little Andrak. "I take it from the attempt to flush us that it's time to leave. Might I suggest running?" He tucked the Abaquen into his jabat, ensuring it was secure, and leaped off the step. He landed on the eddying surface of the water with a small splash. Rather than yanking him from his feet and carrying him away, the torrent merely felt slippery, like wet clay, obliging him to proceed in careful, loping hop steps. The water appeared to be gushing from the lower front of the room, where it took a step down from the laboratory on the other side, which explained why it was a step lower in the first place, and why all the cabinets and cases housing the Nethermancer's valuables were elevated 4 feet off the ground. With an appreciative nod at their engineering, Blaze galloped right through the wall. The laboratory on the other side was bone dry. The roar of the water in the other room was now a muffled hiss. From the tables, the skeletons of the birds and rodents seemed to be watching him. The feeling was so strong that he stopped and peered at them, searching them for signs of an ethereal animation. But a closer inspection revealed they were just standard piles of dead stuff. The little Star Eater slitted his eyes at him. In the real world, the demons looked flat and unreal, but in the shadows, they were as vivid as a tree or a wolf. On a full-sized Andrak, the expression of impatience it was currently wielding on Blaze would have been menacing. As this demon only stood to his mid-thigh, the look was comical instead. Its impatience wasn't unfounded, however. Blaze resumed running, heading across the long room toward the stairwell. As he entered the hallway, an awareness entered the shadows like a shark coming to a reef, questing about with predatory malice. Blaze froze in place and tried to make himself very tall. 3 seconds crept by, then 5, then 10. He still had more than half his shadows left in him, but if he had to wait much longer... A presence hammered into his side, knocking him from the nether like a loose tooth. Swearing extensively, he drew a knife, nicked the back of his arm and sprinted toward the stairs, drawing a sword in his right hand and a small hunk of shadows in his left. He pulled the stairwell door open and listened a moment for the smack of feet, then took the steps, three at a time. He came to the ground floor landing and reached for the door. It flew open before he could touch it. A soldier shouted out in surprise, jabbing instinctually with his short spear. Blaze caught the haft with the edge of his blade, sliding it past him, and stabbed the man in the chest, the churning nether of the Odoshain weapon, parting the soldier's breastbone like boiled chicken. The Andrak ran past the body and out the door. An instant later, a bolt of nether flicked into its side. This appeared to do nothing, but the spear of ether that followed it punched a hole through the demon's neck, spraying shadows across the hall. 30 feet down the way, a sorcerer in light blue robes stood with her feet apart and her hand outstretched. Tendrils of shadows extended from the Andrak as she drew the nether from its body. Blaze spun about and ran deeper into the bastion, the demon flying along behind him. He could feel the nether zipping down the hallway toward them. He flung himself down a side passage. The shadows pounded into the corner with a hail of stone. "I don't suppose you know a way out of here?" Blaze looked to the demon as if he actually expected an answer, and came to the realization that the chaos of the moment had driven him temporarily insane. With footsteps pounding after them, and another lance of nether bending around the corner, Blaze blipped into the shadows and jumped to his left, taking a shortcut through the wall. As soon as he was clear, he dropped back into the physical world, praying the action had been too fast for the enemy nethermancer to track. He found himself in a yawning and empty room. Windows shed light from above, but the openings were nearly 20 feet up and there was no way to climb to them. The presence quested forth again. Blaze wished it had a face so he could punch it. He glanced at the Andrak. "Well, little fellow, how would you like to collect your share of glory?" The demon flexed its claws in anticipation, although Blaze suspected it was less enthusiastic about potential valor than it was about the chance to rip a fleshy human into messy pieces. He moved back to the wall. The presence circled closer, homing in on the Andrak. And Blaze homed in on it. He pointed to a section of wall with his sword. The Star Eater lowered its head and ran full tilt through the wall. Blaze bounced on his heel and followed after it, rolling into the shadows just before he was about to bash his brains out on the stone. In the hallway on the other side, the Andrak threw itself at the sorcerer, who jerked up her hands in surprise. Ether sprayed from her fingers in straight lines, raking tatters from the Andrak. It slashed at her leg, grinning at the sight of the blood flowing from her thigh. Yet she was already sucking the nether from the Andrak's wounds and applying it to her own, the gashes fading as the demon became semi-transparent. Blaze drew his second sword and charged. She backpedaled, the faltering Andrak giving chase and ripping at her shin. The woman drew back her arm, yanking a fat gob of nether from the demon. They both stumbled. She fired a blast of nether at Blaze. He held up the meager bit of it that he could command, waiting until her attack was almost on him before deflecting it. He leaped through the shower of black sparks. She was already drawing more power from the small Andrak, which fell on its face, now ghostly claws outstretched before it. Blaze made an overhand slash toward the sorcerer's head. She threw up her right hand, which succeeded in saving her skull at the cost of sending her hand and half her forearm smacking against the wall. She wailed in the particular kind of panic that overtook people when they watched themselves lose a limb. Shadows whipped around her head. Before she could think about doing anything with them, Blaze stuck his other blade into her gut. She gasped, face going gray. He flexed his elbow, and backhanded his first sword through her neck. Her head landed a foot from her hand. Her mouth hung open, the eyes blinking at him dully. That reaction was one reason he wasn't particularly fond of beheading people. But when you were dealing with nethomancers, it was always best to chop too much rather than too little. He turned to the Andrek. Still with me? It didn't move. Except for the integrity of its body, which was collapsing on itself, Blaze kneeled halfway down, intending to touch the demon on the back, then grunted at himself. I'll remember you, little one. He straightened. Wisps of nether curled away. The Andrak was gone. Blaze glanced up and down the hallway, trying to get his bearings after the chase. Even by the standards of stately castles, the bastion was big. The wrong turn could find him utterly lost in hostile territory. Then again, he had no need to follow the rigid confines of hallways and rooms. He shifted back into the shadows, felt a bit wobbly. Less than 2 minutes before he ran short, he thought. He aligned himself in what he thought was a southerly direction that would take him back to the others, and ran as fast as he could, blowing through a wall. Heading in a straight line, he knifed through a second wall, only to blunder into something yielding yet smothering. It felt clothy. He ripped the tapestry from himself, cast it aside, and sprinted on. Without warning, the bright darkness of the netherworld fell away, replaced by the dull darkness of an average room. Back in the real world, Blaze immediately tripped over a kneeling mat, sprawling forward. He managed to tuck and roll as if that had been his plan all along, but with no one there to witness it, the victory felt hollow. He pressed his palms against his eyes, wanting to groan. He hadn't run out of shadows. He hadn't been forced out by a nethomancer either. Instead, it had been the locking out of the Odosein. How had the monsoon gotten their hands on someone with the power? Had they turned a knight traitor? Or, much like the current rash of sorcerers, did they have a secret training ground of their own? As he took a well-deserved moment to mull all the ways that life was unfair, he spotted a silver lining to his predicament. The room he was in also had windows high up on its walls. Like before, they were too high to get to, but the moon was angling through them from slightly to his right. Given the time of night, that meant the windows were facing south. Keeping one hand on the hilt of his sword, which he'd put away after dealing with the nethomancer, he jogged toward the southern wall. He cracked open the door and peeked into the hallway. Light glowed to his left, strengthening in intensity. A pair of soldiers ran down the corridor bearing a lantern. Blaze let them pass. Once the lantern faded around a corner, he headed the opposite way, turning right at the intersection to resume heading south. Footsteps scraped ahead. Two dim figures spotted him jogging forward. Blaze drew both swords. Their purple light illuminated the gaunt face of Gladik and the warrior's frame of Beck. Blaze ran to meet them. "What are you doing in here?"
"Mitigating your incompetence," Gladik said. "Did you find the Abaquin?"
Blaze sheathed his swords and removed the statue from his jabard. "Would you like to sing my praises now, or wait until things calm down?" Beck moved to touch the Abaquin, then stopped himself, as if it was too holy.
"That is it. The remnant that lifts the blight."
"Then our work here is done. Let's get out of here like it's filled with people trying to kill us."
Gladick turned about and jogged down the passage. Netha wreathed his hand. Blaze cocked his head at Beck.
Hang on. He can use the shutters, but I can't. Are you locking me out of them?
The power slid from Blaze's shoulders like a water-bearer's pole. Beck gestured behind them.
I didn't know it was you. All I knew was that a warlock was at play. I put a stop to everything I could feel.
And nearly put a stop to my heart, too, you—
Three soldiers spilled from a side room. Gladick blasted them into giblets before Blaze could draw his sword. He stepped over the bodies, blood sliding beneath his sandals. The next turn of the corridor took them to the expansive foyer containing the bastion's front doors. Though the room was the size of a small chapel, it was completely aglow with lanterns, which were borne, in turn, by a squadron of monsoon soldiers. They raised their spears and small, round shields. Blaze drew his swords and charged. Looking puzzled and contemptuous, the dozen-odd soldiers formed an inverted chevron, ready to tear him to pieces. Arrowheads of Netha whipped past Blaze's shoulder and thumped into the bodies of the soldiers. Every one of them fell to the ground at once.
That looked like they practiced it!
Blaze vaulted over a still twitching corpse and threw open one of the oversized doors. There was shouting going on from within the bastion, but the night was peaceful with the song of crickets. They ran along the thin strip of land fringing the fortress. The icy canoe rested in the shallows, fog swirling about its edges. It looked a little melty, but Gladick solved that with a wave of his hand, the ether solidifying the boat's underside. They climbed aboard and launched off, Blaze paddling while Beck and Gladick watched for threats.
I was led to believe you were so good at stealing that you could filch a man's own shadow,
Gladick said.
Then why is it that we currently have an entire palace attempting to hunt us down?
Because those cheating bastards tried to stop me from taking their stuff, Blaze said. They used traps and things. Completely unsporting.
One wonders whether—
Gladick was interrupted by a streak of Netha hurtling toward them from the bastion walls. Gladick lifted his hand, meeting it with a wedge of ether. Blaze had his back turned to the conflagration, but the light of the impact sparkled over the water. Gold specks lit up around Beck as he clamped down on the enemy Nethermancer. An arrow plunked into the water to starboard, followed by one to port. Blaze risked a look at Gladick.
Mind putting a stop to that?
Gladick forked his fingers, loosing ethereal missiles toward the battlements. Someone screamed. Gladick cried out in surprise. Impossibly. A flock of shadows was flying toward them from the walls, in direct defiance of the Odosein. Beck's mouth fell open in shock as Gladick released a barrage of ether toward the incoming attack. Beck gathered up motes of the stream, shaping them for use, but it was already too late. Shadow and light met in the air like a thunderstorm on a summer night. Yet just as it looked like every piece had been countered, a follow-up strike of Netha speared into the water, vanishing from sight. It punched through the bottom of the boat in a spume of water. With a series of cracks, like a toppling tree, the ice canoe splintered to pieces. Blaze plunged into the lukewarm moat. He kicked hard for the surface, knowing it wouldn't help, that the Ziki Oko would begin eating him within seconds. His head broke free. Beck rose beside him, clutching uselessly at the remaining chunks of ice, which were far too small to try to ride. They'd crossed most of the moat, but were still 50 feet from the earthworks. They'd be skeletons long before they made it. Then again, he didn't have to swim, did he? Not when he could slip into the safety of the shadows and run across the water. He still had the Abaquen safe in his jabard. All it would take to get out of the moat was to leave Beck and Gladdick behind. He reached for the nether. Chips of gold spun around his head, distracting him for half an instant. They felt closer than ever before, as if he could reach out and hold them in his hand. Lights flashed below the surface of the moat. At first, Blaze thought these were the silvery Ziki Oko converging on their meaty target. But the lights were too bright, and rather than zipping toward the humans, they were plowing into the hand-sized shapes that had been coming toward the three of them. The Ziki Oko were ripped into clouds of scales and blood. Gladdick couldn't possibly hit every single one of the fish, but the ones he missed were swerving course, chomping down on the gobs of raw flesh and sinking bone. The constant strobing of the ether seemed to confuse others, sending them wandering unsteadily away. Gladdick emerged with a gasp.
"Swim, you idiots!"
Blaze kicked his feet, grabbing the paddle he'd dropped when the enemy sorcerer had destroyed their boat. Ether flew about on all sides, like vengeful fairies that had decided to take to the water and make the fish pay for every bad thought they'd ever had. Swimming hard, Blaze kept the nether in his hand the whole way, ready to roll into the shadows if the Ziki Oko broke through the melee of light, blood, and guts. It was all so distracting that he frowned in surprise when he reached out for another stroke and touched solid bricks. He scrambled up the wall so fast he couldn't remember having done it. Beck looked to be all right, but Gladdick was having trouble getting up the wall. Blaze lowered the paddle. Gladdick grabbed it, and Blaze pulled him up. Back the way they'd come, pale hunks of fish bobbed so thickly on the water you could practically have walked across them. The moat began to boil, as if the whole damn thing were suspended over a campfire. But that was just the Ziki Oko eating their own. Their canoe was right where they'd left it, tied to the metal pin in the wall. They dropped into it and headed directly away from the bastion. Horns were already sounding behind them.
"What is the matter with you?"
Gladdick demanded. Blaze half turned, still paddling, but before he could defend himself, Gladdick gestured in Beck's face.
"You were supposed to be neutralizing the sorcerers!"
"I employed my ability as I have been trained," Beck said. "That's never happened before. I must have missed one of them."
"Fine time for your first failure to occur right as we were sailing across a sea of monsters."
"Berate me all you want. I did my duty."
Figuring that the gates would be a swarm with people disinclined to let them through, Blaze cut south through the canals of the merchants and aristocrats, the steep-sided hills looming above them. Horns blatted from all about the city, summoning and directing patrols. Lanterns and candles flared to life across the island. Blaze paddled past the manors, water dripping from his hair and clothes after his dip in the moat, and entered a market district. As they sliced past the dock, a man raised a lantern high above his head.
"There they are! I see the Hari!"
A black bolt whisked into the civilian's chest. He dropped on his rear, still holding up the lantern, face drooping like he'd just lost a bet. But his cry was taken up by others, who poured across the dock, pointing at the canoe and yelling for guards. A high-pitched horn squealed from nearby.
"How curious," Gladdick said. "To them, their horn is a call to brave action. To us, it is a warning to flee for our miserable lives. Yet it is the same sound to us all."
"You should really write that down," Blaze said. "I'd hand you some parchment, but I appear to be occupied with saving our foolish hides."
As they crossed an intersection of canals, a white war canoe rushed at them from their port side. Gladik hulled it with a hammer of nether. Its crew yelled out in anger, paddling the wounded vessel over to the closest dock before it could sink. Another couple of minutes and they were hustling along through the slums of rafts. The people there watched them glumly, but did so in darkness, unwilling or unable to waste a candle. A few of them even looked hopeful. The rebels might have taken the city, but the city hadn't necessarily taken to the rebels. The way things had been going, Blaze expected to reach the city's nets and come face to face with a full-fledged armada. But as they exited the clusters of banana trees, they looked out on open water. Gladik sliced through the fishnets with a blade of nether. As Blaze paddled them past, ether glimmered on the water, knitting the slashed nets back together. He lifted an eyebrow at Gladik. How considerate of you.
By mending the net, it will be more difficult for them to determine which way we went. And for a second there, I thought you might want to save the city's poor from being gobbled by Zikioko.
Blaze steered the canoe back into the wilds of the swamps. The city was lost to the trees behind them. They didn't see any sign of pursuit, but wary of enemy nethermancers tracking them down, they didn't pull ashore on a random island until well after midnight. Blaze shook out his arms, then handed back the carving of the gecko with its tail wrapped around the two bones.
Well, does everything seem to be in order?
The knight turned the figure over in his hands. Dots of stream materialized around him, disappearing as he put them to use.
It's the Abaquen, and it's functional.
And that's all you need. You can free Dante with this.
Eck cupped the statue in his hands.
I can do as I've been trained. I can't promise it will work.
Is the process of beliching someone that much different than blighting them?
If this was known, don't you think Bel Era would have been the one to tell you?
Or not tell me, while lording her knowledge over me.
Blaze knew Beck was right. In fact, he'd known the answer to the question before he'd even said it out loud. Yet he'd felt compelled to ask anyway. Now that they had the Abaquen in hand, nothing stood between them and Dante. Ostensibly speaking, this was a very good thing. But it also meant there was nothing left between them and potential failure.
Plan then. Where's Dante?
Gladik closed his eyes and touched his brow.
He is presently some distance to the east. I would estimate 50 miles, and perhaps more. He has been traveling that way for 2 days now.
Blaze tilted back his head, envisioning the lay of the land.
Not a whole lot over that way, is there? Other than the odd village. Perhaps the Aedan Rane is using Dante to collect more souls from the hinterlands, while the Lich sees to the larger populations.
Gladik lowered himself to his bedroll.
We will begin our pursuit in the morning. We may talk as we travel.
Reasonable an idea as this was, Blaze couldn't get to sleep for a long time. Even then, he couldn't tell if he was awake or dreaming of being awake. He got up at first light feeling impossibly groggy, but he knew getting the paddle going would get his blood moving as well. Besides, now wasn't the time to be weak.
He continues to travel east, Gladik said, as they gathered up their gear. Somewhat to the south as well.
If he keeps at it much longer, he's going to bump right into the hell-painted hills.
Blaze's head was so muddled he could feel his heartbeat in his ears, yet the thought that came to him was as crisp and shiny as cut steel.
What if that is where he's headed?
For what end? To assault it? The Odo Sain could destroy him without suffering a single loss.
I don't know, but it feels wrong. The White Lich wouldn't send him to the spires to die.
If that's his destination, then they have a plan to undermine it or to destroy it.
A plausible suggestion. The spires represent one of the last threats to the Lich's power over Tanaritain. He may not wish to expand his conquest to other lands until he's secured every corner of his own.
A pit was opening in Blaze's stomach. He decided to fill it with hard work. He loaded up the canoe and took up the paddle. It was another warm morning, and he soon discovered the mosquitoes had been at his legs overnight.
Sir Beric, Gladick said once they'd gotten their start-of-the-journey silence out of the way. Dante Galland is extremely dangerous. Although it would please me if you do not repeat this to him, I believe he may be the most potent nethomancer on the continent. How can we help you to confront him?
Beck rested his hand on the gunwale.
None of his warlock tricks will make any difference once he's been bound by the Odo Sain. I can do that at some distance,
but I'll need to be closer to restore his soul. You can help me in several ways, by making sure he doesn't run, by stopping anyone else from attacking me as I close on him, and by making sure that there aren't any surprises.
In that case, I may construct an Andrak or two in order to provide us with more flexibility. When you deploy the Abaquen and transfer the part of your remnant to him, how long does the process take, and what does it entail?
The process should only take a few seconds. I'll use the Odo Sain to locate Dante's connections to the ether, but rather than using my power to shut down his access, I'll use it to create a link to my own light. Normally, this remnant would be closed to me, sealed away by the strength of the owner's will. But the Abaquen works as a key to a lock, or a knife to an oyster shell. All I have to do is touch it with the stream to bring it to bear. It will cut through his resistance on its own. This done, I will connect my remnant to his, and permit mine to flow forth. At last, I'll stop the flow before too much has left me and I accidentally blight myself.
But you've never done this before, have you? Blaze said. What makes you so sure that you can?
Beck gazed back at him.
You're worried for your friend. You should be. But don't be afraid of my inexperience. Nearly everyone else who's ever done this was doing it for the first time, too.
Shouldn't you at least practice? We might only have the one shot at this.
The knight grimaced as if dealing with some visceral pain he knew he could never get rid of. He removed the Abaquen from his jabot and lowered his head. Within moments, golden splinters swam before his face. He sent them spinning toward Blaze. They hit him with the clapping sensation of the Odo Sain, but rather than being cut loose from the nether, his awareness of the shadows expanded, as if he'd emerged from a forested hillside onto a clear ridge. Beck detached a hair-fine thread of stream from what he had remaining and sent it to the Abaquen. It disappeared into the yellow ivory of the gecko. A dreamlike knife struck the center of Blaze's guts. But there was no pain, only the initial shock that precedes it.
Right now, either of us could open our remnant to the other, Beck said. All that's needed is to open the barrier. It will feel like a lid or a plug. Can you feel it?
Blaze reached inside himself. He was expecting to grope about blindly and eventually give up, probably while swearing. Yet he was drawn toward the ether within himself
the same way he was drawn back to Earth after jumping in the air. His mind brushed against a tap. He focused on it. His faint touch was enough to begin to pull it loose. The connection dissipated like a drop of blood in turbid waters. Eck exhaled sharply.
The hard part isn't the ritual. It's finding someone who can do it.
Blaze touched his torso in the soft spot just below the breastbone. Cold sweat had sprung up across his body.
Appreciate the demonstration.
Gladick stirred in the aft of the canoe.
This raises a final point. We have discussed how we will attempt to enact the ritual, but we have not discussed what we'll do if we fail.
Blaze shoved the paddle into the water.
Eck just told you that we won't. He told us that any failure would not be due to inexperience. But there is the matter of Dante himself. He will fight against us, and he has shown a marked capacity to win. If he gets away, then we'll come after him again. We remain uncertain that the ritual can even be performed on a lich. If Beck makes his attempt and learns that it cannot be done, what then? Same as always. We regroup and come up with another plan.
Such as what?
You see, Gladick, I don't know yet. If I did know the solution, I'd skip the whole part where we fail and go right to the success.
We must allow ourselves to carefully think this through,
the old man said.
We learned of this solution through the Odosein, an institution which has resisted the Aiden Rane for hundreds of years, and knows his ways better than anyone else in the world. If they don't know how to lift the blight from a lich, who might we seek to learn from instead?
Is the White Lich the only lich who's ever liched?
Surely someone somewhere in the world can teach us. And if we spend months chasing down this ghost, the lich will have time to swallow Malon, Gask, Narastovic, and all of the lesser kingdoms. Our new knowledge will be wasted, for by then, our foe will wield the power of a god.
Then we won't go anywhere. We'll hunt down the other liches and experiment on them until we work it out.
With whose remnant? If Beck expends his experimenting on another lich, who will be left to—
Blaze stopped paddling, twisting about to get a good look at the old man.
What are you trying to convince me of, Gladick? That sometimes things don't work out the way you planned? Because I feel like that might be the very definition of being alive.
You are looking at this from your heart.
For once, Gladick's voice didn't carry any judgment or scorn.
The heart is a brave leader. It inspires us to blaze trails the mind would be too fearful to start down on its own. But if the heart is brave, it is also blind. If we are to avoid the end of all we hold dear, we must turn over commands to our minds. Only they have the cold clarity to see a way out from the chasm that opens before us.
They stared at each other. Flies buzzed among the trees. Frogs croaked from the reeds. Some things lived, while other things died.
If the ritual fails,
we'll kill him, Blaze said.
We'll kill him, and then we'll make our run at the White Lich and be damned. Is that what you want to hear?
It is not a matter of it being what I wish to hear. It is only a matter of what must be said.
Blaze's heart wanted to argue, but his mind had already seen what they were facing. He could blind himself to it readily enough. People did that all the time, telling themselves what they wanted to hear, what was easy or flattering or comfortable. That was why kings told themselves their blood made them divine, and hence the serfs their slaves. Why fathers filled themselves with rum until they found room in their stomach to swallow the idea that it was better to walk away. Why children and dogs were beaten for their own good. Why so little ever got done, and so much was let to fall apart. He could convince himself it was bound to work out, that even if it didn't work out, they'd find another way. Yes, he could lie to himself easily enough. He, like everyone, had been doing it his whole life. But he knew that if he did so now, when they met again in the mists, Dante would curse him for it. Blaze picked up his paddle and carried on. The next 2 days were of the worst kind, work and worry in equal measure, with no good cheer or comfort to salve the day's many stings, and the only relief to be had in unrestful sleep. It was enough to make Blaze wish that Nethermancers had a way to let you excise the memories you didn't want, or to allow you to exist and function for a given period without retaining any memory of that time. But no, they were too busy playing with their damn rats. Meanwhile, Gladick claimed that Dante hadn't moved position, meaning that he had now spent 3 full days parked on or near the border of the hell-painted hills. If the White Lich had sent him to destroy the spires, why would he dawdle there, awaiting reinforcements? Or had he entered the hills only to be struck down by their corrosion, and was now lying in a state somewhere between death and undeath, beyond all aid? For as much paddling as he did that day, Blaze found himself almost unable to eat. Even the ripe bananas they had taken from passing trees felt too dry to be swallowed. He ate anyway, forcing the mush down with the glum drudgery of climbing a mountain, or, for that matter, of paddling for days across an endless swamp. With the sun ripening to a bloated red, they put in at one of the islands. Gladick estimated they were still 10 to 20 miles away, but there was no talk of lighting a fire that night. Gladick seated himself in their bare-bones camp.
He may not be alone. In the morning, I will create an Andrak to see what lies before us. If he is in the company of many blighted, or the Aedan Rani himself, we will bide our time until an opportunity presents itself. Or for us to create one.
Blaze poked at the ground with a stick.
This still feels strange. Like it might be a trap. It might well be. Would that make any difference? To my determination, no. But it probably makes a big difference in our chances of being fed to the fish and subsequently crapped out across several acres of swamp. It might well be a ruse. However, the Aedan Rane is typically more sophisticated than that. His every action contains many layers, with contingencies for every reaction that he can foresee. I suspect he has sent Dante to pursue a legitimate goal of some kind, while designing the venture in such a way that it can become a trap if we attempt to interfere.
They talked a while longer, weighing different approaches. Once it became clear that they were just rehashing the same tactics over and over, Blaze and Gladick fell into silence, revealing that Beck was snoring and probably had been doing so for some time. The two of them stared into the blank center of the camp where a fire ought to have been.
I have been thinking, Gladick said. Is the quantity of ether and nether within the world fixed and finite?
or is more created over time, as the mill of the heavens grinds on.
Blaze rubbed his eye.
Interesting question. Let me offer a counter-proposal.
Who gives a shit?
The question has deep implications. If the supply of light and shadow is finite, then, as more and more people are born, then more and more ether and nether will be drawn up as their remnants and traces, and hidden away from conventional sorcery when these people die. There would reach a point then, when it has all been converted, and lost in the shadow world, with none remaining in the physical realm. Thus sorcery would pass from the world. Whereas if more light and shadow is added to the earth, there will reach a point when everything is utterly saturated by it. Once it is in every particle of our surroundings and ourselves, I think it possible that we may all be born to the talent of magic.
Blaze eyed him.
That's what you're thinking about right now. Tomorrow, everything hangs in the balance, and your only concern is what the world's going to be like 1,000,000,000 years from now.
What else should occupy my mind at this time? Worry and regret?
That'd be the human response, yeah.
Regret is the most useless of all human emotions. It does nothing but fester, and hence should be lanced like a boil on the soul that it is. I have made mistakes, but I do not regret them.
That's a fine way to pardon yourself for your crimes.
Gladys smiled, amused.
Perhaps it is. Even so, I will not use this time for regrets. I am old, Blaze. Even if we survive the morrow, I only have so many years left to me. Before long I will die. In the past lands, I won't think to ask such questions as whether people like me will eventually become extinct, or if we will become the norm. In the mists, I'll no longer care about these questions. And in the world sea, I will have no need to ask them.
The old man gazed into the night, a thick darkness punctuated by tree-blocked starlight and the fireflies blinking over the water.
The only time to find my answers is now, in this body, on this earth. So that is what I will do.
Sounds great, Blaze said. While you're answering the mysteries of life, I'm going to sleep my ass off.
He wriggled his blanket into comfortable lumps beneath him. Galadic didn't lie down for another 20 minutes, yet somehow the old man fell asleep before Blaze did, making the occasional faint, whinnying noise, as if he were dreaming of being chased by ghosts, or of meeting his gods and being judged by them. Blaze rolled back and forth, seeking the posture that would allow him to be unconscious for a few nice hours. When he couldn't take it anymore, he got up, slinging one of his sword belts over his shoulder, and walked to the edge of the island. He crouched down, resting his forearms across his knees. The moon was almost full, and it glinted on the water, in small patches where it was able to leak through the trees. On most occasions, the swamp felt like a trial to be endured, and occasionally a nightmare to be terrified of. But on that night, it finally felt peaceful. The day to come felt like a dream he hadn't yet lived. What would he do if they failed? Would he really return to fighting the White Lich? At that point, what would it matter? What if he just went back to Narashtovic? It would be easy enough. It was early summer, and the sailing would be good,
He could ask Naren for a trip back on the Sword of the South, or make his way to Kavanna and book passage from there. A few weeks on the warm seas with a jug of grog didn't sound so bad. He'd make port in Narashtovik and take a stroll over to the Citadel, and he didn't think he would even tell them what had happened in the south. Not right away, anyway. But would go straight to Min, and her jaw would drop, and she'd wave her hand in front of her mouth like she did when she was shocked in a good way. A little double tap, as if she was afraid something was going to fall out of it. And then they'd ride away. Not to Pocket Cove, but to somewhere similarly remote. Galador Rift, maybe, although that was too central. Somewhere in the foothills of the Wodens, then. A lake within a forest. Together they'd build a cabin and work the land. A nice little farm. After a year or two, when they were all settled in and didn't have to work quite as hard, they'd start to have children. Two girls and two boys, he thought. Might take some doing to convince Min, since at that point the outside world would likely be coming to an end. But there was always the chance that it would be stopped somewhere, or stall out and take dozens or even hundreds of years for the Blighted to scour every nook and cranny of the land. And even if the world was all crashing down around them, why not live out the rest of their time together as beautifully as they could? The more he thought about it, the more he could see it. The trout feeding on the surface of the lake. The screens or filters they'd have to build into the chimney to break up the smoke to stop it from being seen. They'd have to do funny things with the crops, too. Maybe they'd plant their seeds at random in the rich, cool earth beneath the trees, walking the thin line between tending them enough to produce decent yields, but not making the crops so orderly that they could be seen from a mile's distant ridge. Min was plenty smart, though. They could make it work. It wouldn't all be work, either. The family could explore together. Stuff a bunch of acorns into a padded cloth and sew it up into a ball and kick it around. Swim across the lake and then sleep in the summer sun. Sing songs to each other and tell stories in front of the hearth as the snow fell outside and venison stew bubbled on top of the stove. Teach the kids to farm and fish and hunt like his own dad never had. Blaze knew he was indulging himself, that this could never happen, that the White Lich would destroy them much sooner than this, and that Min would never betray her vows to Pocket Cove by abandoning it. But he let himself fall deeper, allowing himself this one minute to exist in peace. His oldest son would be named Cal, and he'd have blonde hair like his father, with the serious mind of his mother. Once the boy had a few years behind him, and could handle one without hurting himself, Blaze would shape a short bow for him, and show him to use it, sending him out alone that summer to hunt for small game. Once the boy got good at this, he'd start to pester Blaze about when he could go with his father on deer hunts, and Blaze would always tell him the same two things. When you're a little older, when you're a little stronger. It was the second winter since Cal had started his training. The day before had been their first good storm, leaving 4 inches of snow that would show every track. Blaze got up before dawn to stir up the embers in the stove, then went to Cal's bed and shook him awake. Get your bow. Cal's face, initially a portrait of grumpiness, now shined so brightly, Blaze was half afraid it'd wake up the others. The boy hurriedly dressed himself in his coats and fur-lined trousers and his boots. They braced one end of their bows between their feet, bending and stringing the weapons, then went outside. The cold was like a slap to the face. The clouds had gone away, if only for a little while, and the stars twinkled madly,
gazing at their own reflection in the lake. The air smelled like wood smoke and snow. Blue shadows painted everything, and with the starlight on the snow, even the darkness seemed bright, as though they'd stepped out the cabin door and into the netherworld.
"It's cold," Cal whispered.
"That's just the frost demons taking shelter in a warm, open mouth." Blaze reached down and wrapped the boy's scarf firmly about his mouth and chin so he could barely talk. "Much better." Blaze had his bow with him, along with a sword, but he intended to use neither. He led them over the trail they'd worn through the woods to the east, boots squeaking in the powder. Snow clung heavily to the needles of the pines. Blaze kept an eye out for deer, but if he saw any yet, he'd pretend to ignore them. The boy needed to be out of sight of the house, aware of the full vastness of nature and their vulnerability within it. They topped the eastern ridge and dropped down into the valley below. 2 miles from the cabin, Blaze grabbed Cal by the shoulder and hunkered down. The boy crouched beside him. Blaze pointed through the trees. 200 yards away, a deer, either a doe or a young buck, walked slowly through the pines. Keeping low, Blaze circled downwind, Cal sticking to his back like a limpet. The snow muffled their steps. Blaze stopped 100 feet away, which was as close as he dared to creep up on it, but still too far away to make for a good shot, especially with Cal's lighter draw. But that night, they had luck on their side. The deer, a buck with 2 points on one side and a spike on the other, wandered straight toward them for 10 yards, then started to veer toward their right. Blaze nudged Cal and gave him a nod. The boy gave him a look of half panic. Blaze stomped down a smile. "If you think I'll be mad if you miss, imagine how angry I'll be if you don't take a shot." Cal's eyes darted to the side in thought. He thought too much, definitely his mother's son. At last, he lifted his bow and sighted down the shaft of the arrow. His breath streamed away from his mouth. He loosed his arrow. It struck the deer with a thud. The animal jerked forward, legs striking at the ground as if it thought the earth had bitten it. Blaze hopped to his feet, drawing back his arrow, but the buck went down, sliding in the snow. He turned to Cal to give him a good word, but the boy's face was so wrapped, Blaze's throat closed. He set his hand on the boy's shoulder. The vision blurred. Blaze tumbled forward, no longer in control of his own mind. The woods and the snow and the night disappeared, replaced by swamp and mangroves and daylight. 2 women paddled a canoe through the water, their bodies pale-skinned and long-limbed. Blaze could tell at once that they were soldiers. Not from the strength of their shoulders and arms, which was common among Tenarian canoers, but from the dignity of their bearing. The shape of their noses and angle of their jaws marked them as sisters. Everything else about them marked them as Tenarians. But their clothes were simple hides, and their hair had been worked into basic braids and drawn behind their heads, a fashion Blaze hadn't seen in any Tenarian village or city. Everything about them looked to be from an earlier time. He was in the middle of a glimpse. The realization was so startling, Blaze was afraid it had boot him out of itself, like when you became aware you were dreaming. Yet the vision moved on without a hiccup. The 2 women paddled forward, joking and laughing with each other, keeping a casual eye on the trees and the water.
They spoke and travelled like they were out on a hunt, and they were armed enough for one too. But they made no stops to check for tracks